You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, thanks to all of you for coming and spending time. What I'm going to do is to try to cover a lot of material very, very quickly so that we've got time for interactions and discussion. I'm going to talk about the first part, the immersive interfaces for learning, and then all of us can talk about the second part, the opportunities and the perils involved with those. So we'll do some brainstorming on the second topic once you have the background for the first. I want to begin with something that usually comes at the end or not at all in talks, which is why. Why should I care about this stuff? And the why that has kept me involved with immersive interfaces over a 15-year period is basically that we live at a very interesting time in terms of what information and communication technologies are doing. They're changing the knowledge and skills society wants from our graduates. They're changing the characteristics of the learners of every age that walk into classrooms, and yet our methods of teaching and learning tend to remain relatively static. I try to be a 21st century kind of guy, so I have a 45-second version of my presentation. You have to watch closely because 45 seconds goes by fast. I'm not going to show you the rest of that. It's a Panasonic marketing video, and their solution is to buy lots of Panasonic equipment. But this illustrates that these three trends are not distinct from one another. They're very richly interrelated. So why immersion as some kind of an answer to this challenge? First, what is immersion? It's the impression that you're participating in a comprehensive, realistic experience. And immersive interfaces have kind of a gotcha capability built into them. Fred Brooks, who was one of the pioneers of virtual reality, likes to tell a story from the late 1980s when he had a head-mounted display system set up at North Carolina Chapel Hill. One of his colleagues, who was very cynical, said that he did not believe in immersion at all, and nobody could immerse him. So Fred had modeled a little kitchen that he was planning to build in his new house, a very cartoon-like model, and they put the head-mounted display on his colleague, and his colleague is kind of poking around, trying to give Fred advice on his kitchen, and after about 5 minutes, he bent over to look inside the virtual oven, and when he was going to get up, he put his hand on the virtual countertop to provide leverage, and Fred said, gotcha. And that's what tends to happen in immersive interfaces. Design is important in this. Virtual interfaces for immersion combine actional, symbolic, and sensory factors, and we could talk a lot about that, but I'm just going to make it as a claim that we can discuss later if you like. There are many ways in which immersion can help learning and can address the issues that I identified with 21st century classrooms being needed but not being here. I'm going to highlight three of them in the talk: multiple perspectives, situated learning, and shifts in identity. And just to contextualize my own work, my colleagues and I have a suite of 21st century skills that we're very interested in teaching. They're the kind of skills that underlie teams that work on really wicked problems like global climate change or international terrorism, the meltdown of the world financial system, where the problem is so hard that no single individual can understand it. You have to have a team of people with different skills, so there's a Tower of Babel issue in terms of the team working together. You have to find the problem and frame it before you can try to solve it, because it's a nest of interrelated problems. We wanted to see to what extent we could teach these skills in the middle school, which is arguably the first developmental stage when kids can abstract enough to be capable of doing this. And we identified immersive interfaces as central to that for reasons I'm going to talk about later. So I'm going to sketch three kinds of immersive interfaces that give different flavors of immersion. The first is a kind of augmented reality interface. The second is the Alice in Wonderland interface that underlies internet games and Second Life. And the third is the full virtual reality or cave interface with sensory immersion. So let's talk about augmented reality first. In augmented reality, you are in the real world. You're not an avatar inside of a virtual world. You're surrounded by the real world, not by digital reality. But you have a device with you that lets you overlay the virtual world on the real world. The entertainment industry is very interested in this. And I want to show you a concept video, not a product video, not a research video, but a concept video that Hewlett-Packard put out for a game that would use this kind of immersion.
Luring him down these alleys.
Now, there are lots of reasons to be nervous about that, okay, as an educator and as a parent. But that is an interface now that the entertainment industry is looking at very seriously. What are we doing with that interface from an entertainment perspective? And our perspective is looking more at the cell phone than something like the PSP as a delivery platform. We have a grant from the U.S. Department of Education to raise the test scores in English language arts and in mathematics in middle school. We are interested in the 21st century skills I talked about earlier, so we're trying to do both at the same time. I want to show you just a little bit of one of our curricula called Alien Contact, and that will give you a sense of how we're using the augmented reality interface. So here's just a little bit about Alien Contact. You'll see we're using it in a somewhat different way than the entertainment industry is thinking about. Let's see if I can get this bigger. Nope, that didn't work. All right, it is what it is.
To assess the strengths and weaknesses of augmented reality as an instructional model, we designed a middle school mathematics and literacy curriculum called Alien Contact. In Alien Contact, the students are presented with the following scenario. Aliens have landed outside of their school and seem to be preparing for a number of possible actions, including peaceful contact, invasion and plundering, or simply returning back to their home planet. Working in teams, the students explore the area, interviewing virtual characters, collecting digital items, as well as solving mathematics and literacy problems to determine why the aliens may have landed. Each team has different roles, and depending upon his or her role, each student will see different pieces of evidence. To successfully navigate and solve problems, the students must jigsaw their information and collaborate with their teammates. In the following clip, you will see students beginning to explore the area outside of their school. What the students see on their handhelds will be represented in the corners of the screen.
Oops. Sorry, didn't mean to lose that.
Look, I've got to be honest with you. All this hype about aliens trying to harm us is just that, hype. If the aliens wanted to do something to us, they would have done it by now. Besides, uranium isn't deadly to humans as long as we're careful with it.
As students explore and investigate, they will encounter various mathematics and literacy challenges that, if solved successfully, will reveal the aliens' intentions. The students then form hypotheses and present their findings to the class. During our pilot implementation, both students and teachers reported that the interactive and experiential nature of augmented reality is an effective and engaging way to learn math and English.
All right, so that gives you a little bit of a background on what that interface is like. You are wandering around in the real world as yourself, but you're able to meet virtual people, find virtual artifacts, do different kinds of things that intermix the real world and the virtual world. Here, we do identity primarily through roles. So you're yourself. You're in your identity. But each identity gets different information. The chemist, the linguist, the FBI agent, the computer expert get different information. And so to succeed, the team has to work within the roles and has to play the different roles. This is an interface that's going to evolve rapidly. Some of you may remember the Little Professor. That was a powerful handheld device a generation ago. Of course, in 2008, our smart cell phones are much more than that. Experts in the hardware industry tell us there will be as much evolution in wireless mobile devices in the next 10 years as there was in the last three decades. No one knows quite what those are going to look like, but everyone will have one, even in developing countries. And so thinking about what to do with this interface in terms of immersion is a very interesting opportunity. All right, the second interface is the Alice in Wonderland interface. Same purpose again, from our perspective, 21st century skills, wicked problems, teams have to collaborate to solve them. They're mixing information in a jigsaw. Each person has a different kind of expertise. We have our own system for a multi-user virtual environment, a MOOV. We don't use Second Life for reasons that I can discuss. Everyone has an avatar. I make my avatars 30 years younger and 30 pounds thinner. It's great that we can look as we feel in the virtual world rather than as nature has left us. And this is an interface that provides a kind of partial immersion. You're sitting in front of a monitor. You're not fully immersed in a virtual world. I want to show you again a little bit about a middle school curriculum. This is a curriculum that is now science-oriented. We're trying to teach inquiry. We're trying to teach some middle school content that's part of the national science standards, but we're also working to teach 21st century skills. And the easiest way for me to do that is to show you a video of our work being used in a classroom setting.
going high tech, a new online video game is being used in just a few classrooms across the nation, including Plattsburgh. It's part of a research project through Harvard University. Local kids are learning a whole lot more than just science. UCNY's Haley Lampert has tonight's Champlain Connection.
There's an online video game, a chat room, and dozens of animated characters.
I think that's really neat. It's a lot of fun.
And while these kids are having fun, they're also learning.
Have you dealt with the scientific method yet?
Kate Messner is an English language teacher at Stafford Middle School in Plattsburgh.
I love how motivated they are, but I also love that they are working so hard and not even realizing it. When I come in here and you hear these furious fingers typing.
About half of the 7th grade students at Stafford are participating in a science research project through Harvard University. It's a new type of learning that uses a virtual online video game set in the year 1879 in the fictional town of River City. The characters in the town are plagued by several epidemics and infectious diseases. The students apply skills they've learned in the classroom to figure out what's going on in River City.
They've learned the scientific method in science class. This is reinforcing that. They've learned steps to solving a problem. We work on critical reading and critical thinking skills in English class all the time, and that's a real key component.
We also get to finally use the stuff we've been learning in science, like the scientific method and stuff. When we learned it, I was kind of like, oh, there's no way I'm ever going to need this unless I become a biologist or something.
But in River City, these students are biologists.
I didn't really like science, but now I like it a lot more.
That could be because the online video game aims to reach a new generation of learners.
This generation is a generation of multitaskers. They do their homework at night with their math book here and their MP3 player and their chat program open on the computer. And, you know, they work on the math and then they IM their friend and say, what'd you get for number 7?
And for the kids, the best part is...
We're not in the classroom listening to a teacher go on and on and on. You're figuring it out by yourself.
For the Champlain Connection, Haley Lampert, News Channel 5.
All right, so that's a little background on some of our work with the second interface. And here, beyond the shift in identity, something that we're using is situated learning. Situated learning is something common in life but very seldom seen in classroom settings. And an example is a medical internship. You finish your medical education, you've got high board scores, you've got high grades, you think you're really something. You go off to your teaching hospital, and in about 4 hours, you realize you're in deep shit. Because nothing looks like the multiple choice questions on the board, nothing looks like the little research papers you wrote for your professor in med school, and people are going to die if you make the wrong choices. Fortunately, the folks in the hospital know that you don't know jack about applied medicine. And so they put you on the fringes of a community doing expert practice. There's not a teacher, there's not a curriculum, there's not a mentor, but there is the opportunity for a lot of tacit learning, watching people who know what they're doing, and a lot of little apprenticeships. And over time, you move from the fringes of that community to the center of that community as you build up your skills. Part of what we're studying is whether we can take environments isolated from the real world, academic settings, do virtual situated learning, and then take advantage of the strengths of the classroom for reflection and interpretation. Again, we're trying to teach 21st century skills, so we're forming a learning community, but a learning community, even though the kids may be in the same classroom, that is distributed because the immersive medium mediates their interactions. Their avatars are having to communicate with one another rather than their being able to use the full bandwidth of face-to-face as in augmented reality. And anything you can build in augmented reality, you can build in this interface. So then the question becomes, which do you use when? That's another kind of the things that we're studying. Third type of immersive interface, this is full virtual reality. And my work with full virtual reality was before I came to Harvard at George Mason University for 6 years in the 1990s. When I came to Harvard, George Mason University said, we want to keep all the VR equipment. So the equipment rotted down there with nobody to use it, and I wasn't able to reproduce it here, which was one reason I moved into this second interface, which was emerging at that time. But we used head-mounted displays. We had grants from the National Science Foundation to give a sense of how far on the bleeding edge we were. In 1992, when we started the work, we went out and bought a used $400,000 used supercomputer that today would be viewed as a low-end PC in terms of its processing power, way below a kind of standard gaming system. But at the time, something that let us explore the educational potential of this interface. We built two worlds for learning difficult topics in science, one in the elementary school, one in the high school. I want to show you just briefly what those worlds looked like. This is a little different content. This is now not 21st century skills. It's trying to take advantage of some of the capacity of full immersion to teach really complicated things. And if I were building in VR today, I might build somewhat different things.
In an open world, 5th and 6th grade students can learn about Newtonian dynamics and mechanics by going inside a three-dimensional world without gravity or friction. Balls of different masses move and collide along a corridor of evenly spaced columns. Learners can be inside a ball, or can beam to a different frame of reference to view what's happening from another perspective. They can see, hear, and feel forces that shape how objects move and collide. Learners can also alter our ball's mass or velocity to see how this changes what is happening. Intangible abstractions like kinetic energy are made visible and numeric to aid understanding interrelationships and to link formulas with the system's behavior. The student inside the VR equipment works in a team with other learners, collaborating to make predictions, interacting with phenomena, and reflecting on what's experienced. In Maxwell World, high school students can learn about electrostatic fields. They can create a field by placing source charges, then see field lines that represent the forces and energies this generates in that region. Learners can fly around inside the field space to see what's happening from different perspectives. They can move and drop test charges to measure the intensity of forces or energies at a particular point. Students can even shift their frame of reference to ride on a test charge and be pulled around in the field space by the forces acting on it. By moving the source charges, learners can see how all other representations change in response. Students work as teams, rotating the role of being inside the VR world. They predict what an intervention will do, then experience what happens, and finally discuss how these observations differed from their expectations.
One in that charge and then one in that charge.
Okay. So, three different interfaces, three different levels of immersion, and different kinds of educational leverage that go with each one. In this case, we're using frames of reference. For those of you that may remember your physics, this is very important in physics. There's the exocentric view where you're outside. There's the egocentric view where you're inside. What we found is the bicentric perspective is very important and powerful. It doesn't have to be just head-mounted displays. I'm working with someone who just graduated from Carnegie Mellon University, who's in this area now, who specializes in creating cave-like environments. A cave, as you can see from the image on the right, is a room in which the four surfaces are active, three walls and either the floor or the ceiling. So if you're standing inside of that room and you're looking towards those four surfaces, you're fully immersed without having to wear something like a head-mounted display. There are different kinds of devices that can be used to control those sorts of virtual realities. What he specializes in is creating museum exhibits. So in Pittsburgh, he created an Egyptian temple, and people could go inside of this virtual Egyptian temple and interact with various aspects of it. Other groups have focused more on content knowledge. This is a virtual Puget Sound that was done at the University of Washington in the early part of this century. Students could fly around above and underwater and take on different points of view. There's also some very interesting social psychology research. Right now, we're in the real world. Some of you are closer to me, some of you are farther from me. I can only look at one of you at a time, or maybe a couple of you at a time, depending on how close or far away you are. If we were doing this in virtual reality, each one of you could have the sensation of being right in front of me simultaneously. Each one of you could have me looking at you all the time. You might or might not like that, but what the social science research is demonstrating is that's very powerful in terms of keeping attention, not surprisingly. And that kind of research can be generalized into worlds like Second Life. We don't do stuff like that now, but those worlds could certainly be made more magical than they are in terms of how the interface handles social presence. So to wrap up, because I want to have lots of time for discussion, I've tried to sketch three different interfaces for learning that deal with immersion. I've tried to sketch some of the different reasons that these interfaces are powerful in terms of engagement and learning, and how they can be used to teach not just basic skills, but quite sophisticated skills at the same time. To open up a discussion in terms of both opportunities and perils, identity is very interesting to think about in these worlds. My older daughter is at American University. She's a junior there, and she reports to me that she's very discouraged about her dating life because she says many of the men are gay, and the ones who aren't gay are all World of Warcraft players. And so she never gets the opportunity to go out. I don't know how true this is, but the point is that the World of Warcraft is an environment in which many people now seem to have their primary identity. That is, their primary identity may be a druid priest at level 72, and every now and then they have to come out into the real world in order to make enough money so that they can, you know, continue their World of Warcraft identity. That's a little scary. And it's a little scary, too, to think about kids growing up not even seeing the real world because they're constantly putting an overlay device in front of it. So it's easy for us to imagine the positive situation of the urban kid who suddenly can go back in time and become a scientist inside of River City, contrasted with somebody that gets really addicted to having an identity in the virtual world because it's a form of escape from the real world, but then becomes successively less and less empowered in order to be effective in the real world. So I am happy to open it up and have you ask questions or make comments, talk about why you came. I'm happy to talk about anything. Yes.
I've been aware of the River City project for a while, and what interests me is I see the value of and ease of taking a young learner who lacks context and immersing them in a variety of ways. But I'm looking at it from a university point of view and wondering if we can do the same thing with more sophisticated students and what the result is. I see it happen in Second Life, but they aren't necessarily students from an institution like Harvard, and I don't say that, you know, but there's a lot of young learners from less sophisticated places, and I'm wondering if you've looked at that. I mean, I work with Brian Carter out in central Missouri on virtual Harlem and Montmartre, and sure. Work with his students and see some very interesting things happening, but I don't know about the quality of the immersion.
Well, I think one... A new project that we're starting, that we're working on, is to build virtual ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And let me talk about that because I'm really most comfortable in my field, which is science education, and willing to speculate, there's a chair right here, but maybe less comfortable with some of the other alternatives. So a virtual ecosystem can be simple enough that a middle school student can wander around in it. And there are many urban kids who just do not have access right. to interesting kinds of ecosystems that we can create virtually. But you can also imagine at the university level, potentially even at the graduate level in ecosystem science, having something that's really complicated, that's deliberately made by faculty to be a very challenging ecosystem to diagnose in terms of what's going wrong, a very exotic system that even graduate students at Harvard, unless they traveled halfway around the world, might not be able to experience directly. So I think the complexity of this situated learning can be scaled up or scaled down, and in fact within the same application it can be scaled up or scaled down. So you can sort of have a complexity lever potentially that you move up or move down that lets you set it for the middle school level, the high school level, the college level, the graduate level in terms of complexity. Nobody has built something like that.
Yeah.
But there's no technical reason why someone couldn't.
But the creation, the more complex these immersive environments become, the more expensive they are to create. The more useful they are oftentimes associated with the more particular they are. In other words, you have a particular exercise that you're running a group of middle school students or whatever from, and you're working on grants to produce these environments. But I think about, you know, I've watched a university professor try and create a complex environment, and I mean, I don't know, I'm just puzzled by I'm not puzzled by its value, but I'm puzzled about its future.
Well, it depends on the authoring shell. And the great advantage here about all of these is that they're driven by the entertainment industry. The education market is never profitable enough for us to get sophisticated tools by industry building them for us. But entertainment is enormously profitable, and then we refit these tools to our purpose. So I play, in my very limited spare time, a game called Oblivion. And in Oblivion, in the authoring shell for Oblivion, which is proprietary, there are very elaborate and powerful ways of scripting agent behaviors so that you're not sitting there and writing second by second what the agent does. You're giving relatively general instructions that the agent then executes day after day after day with interesting little variations built into them in ways that make it seem like a realistic environment, deepen the sense of immersion. Now, one of the things that we're studying with this new grant is, in a modern gaming shell, can we script the ecosystem dynamics so that they are emergent? So that instead of sort of top-down faking how the ecosystem works, which is what we do in River City, we bottom-up script animal behaviors, plant behaviors, physical dynamics of water, and so on, and it get maybe not really sophisticated things, but at least a lot of the stuff that that then we don't have to fake, and so we can put a little bit of time into faking the complex things. And the claim that I would make is that within 5 years, we probably will be able to build mixtures of emergent behaviors and faked behaviors that really are compelling in terms of complex dynamics. Yeah?
I'm wondering why you chose to make River City historically situated, because it seems like a lot of the times when kids play games, it kind of removes them from contextualizing what they're doing in the first place, and then to situate it historically might add another layer of being removed from seeing the relevance of what they're learning.
There were two reasons why River City is set in the past, one primary and one secondary. The primary reason is that we needed our kids to be experts. That is, we were most concerned with helping the students who, even by middle school, had already given up on school, given up on themselves as learners, didn't possibly believe they could be scientists, and so on. And the great advantage to history is that the least academically proficient student in middle school today knows more about disease transmission than the most sophisticated person in 1870 knew before the development of microscopes. So it's back to the future, right? You get the back to the future thing where you become an expert in the past. That was the dominant reason, and it's worked really, really well for us. The secondary reason was, even though we were getting funding from the National Science Foundation, which by its mission is limited to the STEM fields, I wanted to show that you could teach multiple things at the same time within this environment, that you could teach science, that you could teach history. In the video, you see an English teacher actually using this to reinforce parts of her curriculum. So it was a demonstration of concept that I wanted to build in. Does it make transfer harder? That's a tough question. I'm not sure that putting it back in history makes transfer harder. I do agree that making it different from now starts to make transfer harder. That's a long discussion about transfer. Yes.
I was struck in the introductions that the Harvard libraries have an outpost in Second Life, but I gather, maybe about to be corrected, that they don't have an outpost in Wikipedia. And it made me wonder...
You use it.
I'm sure you use it. Certainly. Yeah. So it made me wonder... It sort of takes your point that there's something about creating a virtual place that attracts people to it, even if they're not sure why, and a non-virtual place that might not draw people, even though by all lights they ought to be there. So it made me wonder, do you think of Wikipedia as an immersive environment? And if you don't, what would it mean to make it so, and do you think it would improve it?
That's a very interesting question. I said at the very beginning that the factors that affect immersion are sensory immersion, and clearly Wikipedia wouldn't work along that line as it's currently constituted. Actional immersion, this is something like being able to fly in the virtual world when you can't fly in the real world. Wikipedia doesn't work on that dimension. And symbolic immersion. Symbolic immersion is what you get late at night if you're reading a horror novel. You're just, you know, reading words on a page, but you find your hair starting to rise if the author knows what they're doing with symbolic immersion. Wikipedia can have that kind of an effect, depending on what you're reading about or what you're co-creating. I think that the interesting example that I would take would be something like a fan fiction site for Harry Potter. That is not Wikipedia in the sense that it's attempting to reproduce accurate knowledge about the real world. It is like Wikipedia in the sense that it's trying to reproduce accurate knowledge about a world. In this case...
Which Wikipedia does too,
yeah,
actually. They
yeah.
have, you know, entries for characters on TV
right.
shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Scooby-Doo is real to many of the people who write those entries. But...
I can see where you've been looking lately.
Yes. My all their life. But the... you can imagine... taking the equivalent of the Wikipedia for their Harry Potter world and putting it inside of a Harry Potter world. So now your avatar is Hermione Granger, goes to the library in Hogwarts and helps to write, you know, the entries in the history of Hogwarts related to Harry Potter.
You could even take a horror book and do that. You could have Hermione go to the library and read a horror book,
yes,
and then the hairs
could.
On the back of your neck go up.
Potentially,
yeah.
Potentially. Now, again, it's tricky because suppose we were all meeting in Second Life for me to do this lecture. Would the lecture be better? I would argue not. In fact, I would argue that the lecture would be worse because we benefit from the bandwidth and the social presence of the real world. And there's nothing about my being an avatar or you being an avatar and lecturing that would make the difference. The technology is a catalyst, but the technology is not the agent that's powerful. The agent is the content. The agent is the pedagogy. The agent is the experience that the technology enables. And let's face it, the experience of a lecture is not a very powerful experience to enhance. So I haven't really answered your question. I think it would take a lot of discussion to answer your question. But the vehicle that I would start with would be something like fan fiction. And if you could find a way to make fan fiction powerful in a virtual world, then I think it would be really interesting to start looking at Wikipedia.
But if you, one of the projects I'm working on
involves bringing in Islamic and other medieval and late medieval manuscripts into Second Life, taking JPEGs and creating them, and there are people creating these things. If you can, for instance, you can take a class of students to Houghton Library and sit them in front of a certain set of medieval manuscripts and have it be a very powerful experience, probably the most powerful experience, face-to-face. However, there are groups of manuscripts that you can't put together and experience as a group of people except in an immersive environment like that. Mm-hmm. So that it may not be a substitute for face-to-face, and I would absolutely agree with that. There are things that can happen in these other environments that cannot happen, except maybe, you know, it's like putting together an art exhibit where you bring the Van Goghs from all over the world. How often does that happen? Not very often. But you can do that in an immersive environment. In a situated such that the environment itself begins to contribute to the power of the art.
Yes. And so if you went back to the cave concept.
Right.
And you set up a virtual art museum just for Van Gogh, with not only caves displaying the work in high resolution, but caves displaying different, you know,
Where he was.
Yeah, right. And even a cave that presented what it might be like to see the world through paranoid schizophrenia, as he was at the end, that would be a very, very powerful thing. That would get back to some of the German Expressionist movies from the early part of the 20th century. Yes?
So I'm curious how you would weight the different factors that make, that at least I'm hearing, seem to make immersive education so powerful, and I'm hearing a couple, and one of them is basically the agency that you're giving the students, and if that was the most important, then it seems like we can do this, a lot of this, without the technology, and it's just a matter of translating better. Another would be the models that you're building into these systems, such as what you're describing as in an ecosystem. The emphasis there would be on making sure that things are accurate and the complexity scales to whoever the user can handle. And then the third is the actual technology of the visual and sensory immersion. In which case, my concern is that, as you were saying, you're always going to be at least one, if not two or three, steps behind the commercial vendors. And if they're setting the standards for what kids or anybody thinks is being immersive, then you know, the educational applications will always be the equivalent of black and white movies without sound. So I'm wondering how if there are other factors that kind of add up, and what gives you the hope that you can keep up with the commercial folks.
First, which factors are important for immersion always depend on what you're teaching, who you're teaching, and what your instructional goals are. So this is no different than any other kind of educational experience. If you're teaching a bunch of kids who've given up on themselves, the identity factor might be most important. If you're teaching this group, people who have strong identities and probably high sense of self-efficacy, then you're not going to focus so much on the identity factor. You're going to focus maybe on the situated learning aspects of it. Specifically in terms of fidelity, there have been many, many studies of fidelity in learning, because fidelity is a black hole. You can pump enormous amounts of money into fidelity and never catch up to the real world. And what all the studies on fidelity in learning have shown across the military, across medicine, across flight simulation, and so on, is you need high fidelity on the parts of the learning where fidelity is important in the learning itself. For example, if you're teaching people to read x-rays, you have to have high fidelity x-rays if they're virtual. But you can have low fidelity for the parts of the experience that are not directly related to what you're learning. And if the experience is engaging, the learners are immersed and they don't care about the low fidelity. We've used River City with close to 15,000 students. We have never had a student complain that it was too cartoon-like. Now, do they believe that it's cartoon-like? Absolutely. It doesn't look remotely as photorealistic as the games that they play now, but they don't care because their experience doesn't depend on the photorealism. It depends on the Back to the Future metaphor. It depends on puzzling out what's happening in this city. It depends on suddenly being an expert instead of being a doofus in school that everybody thinks doesn't know anything. It depends on a lot of things that have nothing to do with fidelity. And that's why we can get away in education with being one or two or three generations behind, except if we're trying to teach things where fidelity is really, really important, in which case, we don't want to be one or two or three generations behind.
Yes, I've done the planning quantitative analysis of achievements. You're probably familiar with EdLabs here at Harvard. Have you done any quantitative analysis of, let's say, performance and achievement of students who've used this method in terms of improvement grades from, say, C to a B plus, an A, et cetera?
Oh, absolutely. All of these projects are based on, they're research projects. They're based on documenting student gains. And in River City, for example, we have four different pre-post measures: content, scientific inquiry, self-efficacy, and engagement with science. We have a summative performance measure, which is a letter to the mayor that you write. We have embedded formative assessments that help us see learning trajectories within River City. And we're now looking at taking the event logs, the very detailed, time-stamped micro-records of students' behavioral patterns in River City, and seeing what conclusions we can draw from those about their proficiencies in different kinds of things. Typically, what the research literature shows for immersive environments is what the research literature shows for any form of educational activity, which is, if it's well-designed, you get gains in learning, and if it's not well-designed, you don't get gains in learning. And the environment itself, because it's just a catalyst, doesn't automatically create anything. So what research is really articulating is, what does well-designed mean when you're talking about immersion? And there are many, many, many unanswered questions in connection with that. Yes.
Well, I love the idea that in River City, students are not, get the experience of being an expert simply by knowing what they know. I think that's wonderful. Assuming that things go as you would like in every regard, so the most optimistic case, how important, how dominant, how much of a student's day do you think is spent in these sorts of environments? And how much of this is a special activity, sort of the film strip fun part of the class? Film strip, I know, dates me quite a bit.
I understand. I understand the reference, unfortunately. First, I think the answer, as with any form of educational technology, is very dependent on developmental level. So when I do talks about this work, one of the things that elementary teachers ask is, well, you know, would you do this in first grade? Would you do this in kindergarten? How much of this should students have? And my answer, course, is I would be very, very cautious about using immersive environments with young children, because we know that the development of the neurological system depends on direct action. So you don't learn over and under by having your avatar crawl over and under something. You learn over and under by crawling yourself over and under something, and it would be a terrible mistake to do that. That said, you look at very young kids, and they get involved in things like Club Penguin, and they have a great time inside of them. My little daughter has more webkins than Noah, I think, in terms of all the different sorts of virtual animals that you can have and have fun playing with the virtual animals. So in moderation, it makes perfect sense. As you get older, you don't have to worry about that so much. I would say that 20%, no, maybe, 15% maybe. If I had the expertise and the resources to build a virtual environment for every course that I taught, I would use it probably three times I would use it at the very start of the course, and students would go in, and they'd be lost, and they'd be confused, and they'd be frustrated, and they'd come back out, and I'd say, now, this is why you're taking the course, right? At the end of this course, you will be able to have power within that environment that you do not have now. And then in the middle, we do sort of a formative experience inside of the virtual environment. Here's what I understand so far. Here's where I'm still lost and confused. And then at the end, you do some kind of summative performance assessment. That's one model of how to think about it. 15%, 20%, that's questions for research. But again, they probably depend on the subject matter, the age of the learner, characteristics of the learner, what your instructional goals are. If you're doing surgical simulators, if you're doing flight simulators, maybe it's 90% of the time that students spend. Yes?
I was curious whether anyone had done sort of side-by-side evaluations as far as the effectiveness of these spaces versus other interventions where the teachers are putting the incredible amount of effort and creativity that have obviously gone into these projects. I think just to put forward a null hypothesis, right, you could expect learning to increase in any situation where teachers are putting an enormous amount of creativity into changing a lesson plan. To me, some of the examples that you showed don't necessarily tell me anything about immersion. They tell me about engaged and involved teaching. And I wonder, in some senses, just to put a really cynical view here, if really the power of immersion in some ways is that it seems to be something that some educators get really excited about and therefore leads them to do a great deal more creativity and lesson planning than they otherwise might do. Has anyone attempted to sort of do a side-by-side on sort of other creative interventions and their efficacy versus anything specific to the immersive setting?
Well, first, the question is very appropriate in terms of policy, because as in any other field, if somebody wants to sell an intervention as valuable, the question is always, what else could you do with the same amount of resources? And in education, you can say, well, what if you raise the teacher's salary? What if you lowered class size? What if you had, you know, 20 hours of professional development? What if you did this? What if you did that? The first thing to say about these virtual worlds is that they scale largely without cost. So the cost of doing River City with 30 kids is comparable to the cost of doing River City with 3,000 kids. In terms of delivering River City itself, once it's built, it's built. And because schools already have computer labs that they've invested in for other reasons, a teacher saying, let's go down to the computer lab and do River City and it's free from Harvard, the marginal cost of adding is relatively low. Now, does it do things that a skilled teacher could somehow do? I think not. I don't think even the most skilled teacher could give students the sense of going back in time. I mean, you can put on a George Washington costume and kind of bounce around the classroom and kids will be engaged. We've seen teachers do that. God bless them. But I think we have ways of doing that better now through virtual worlds. So where the virtual world is replicating what the teacher can do anyway, like a lecture, there I agree with you in terms of your skepticism. Where the virtual world is creating a situation that even the most creative teacher might be able to do, I'm more skeptical. Now, how are we testing this claim that I'm making? Both for River City and for Alien Contact, and even for the virtual reality, we had control conditions. In River City and in Alien Contact, the control conditions are paper-based games. So they reflect the same content, the same amount of time, the same pedagogy to the extent it's possible with paper, but no technology. And what we have found is a strong difference in engagement. In River City, we found a positive difference in learning. With Alien Contact, which is basically a first-generation curriculum, we're breaking even in terms of learning. And, you know, we think that we can do better than that, but of course we have to show that we can do better than that before I can make a claim about it. But yes, I think it's very important to always ask first, if I took out the technology and I simply did the same kind of thing without technology with a creative teacher, would my engagement and learning be comparable? And second, if I just forgot about the intervention altogether and took the same amount of resources and did something else, would my gains be as good or better? Those are always appropriate questions.
Well, I love your presentation, but I have a restriction regarding university education in social sciences. Mm-hmm. I myself teach law back in my country, and basically what you expect as a law teacher, I think everywhere, from your students is imagination, of course. And on the other hand, you are expected to lead them into the issue, to immerse them or to let them immerse into the issue. But I think this imagination and immersion are like entirely different, because essentially they are about immersion into what is just, what is fair, or at least what is convincing. In all of the three points, being just, fair, and convincing, regards another person. It is entirely interhuman. And so I'm wondering to what extent you think this virtual or artificial, in fact, interface enables this interhuman relation, or hinders it, maybe?
First, I would not claim in any way that immersive interfaces are equally powerful in all subject matters. I can imagine subject matters in which they probably have very little leverage. Second, I don't know the answer to your question, but let me tell you about a capability of the technology that you did not see in the videos. One of the things that we can do in River City is to have two people in the same world who see different things and who experience different things. So you're standing next to somebody, you're talking to somebody, you feel as if you're having the same experience together, but in fact you're having different experiences. And that's a capability that the technology can deliver. How might that speak to your point? Well, suppose I built in this country a pre-Civil War environment in which I'm a slave owner and you're a slave, and our avatars are walking down the street together, and I see my friends waving to me and smiling at me, and you see people spitting on the sidewalk in front of you and people jostling you and people crossing the street to get away from you. Then if you have a conversation about what that stroll was like, that's a very interesting conversation. That leads into a kind of immersive experience about social perspective taking, which is not something that I know a lot about, but I have a colleague, Hunter Gelbach, who knows a lot about. I think that to the extent that we can use immersive environments to enhance social perspective taking, seeing the world through somebody else's eyes and shoes, that could be powerful. But I don't know, you know, how well that would work, really.
Yes. I actually had experience going to college at Carnegie Mellon and you know, having worked in the School of Computer Science, and to the extent that we've been very immersed in using communications technology at Carnegie Mellon, I think we are very much in a position to say we were living in some kind of an augmented reality.
Okay.
I've not seen many of the things used there anywhere else, but thing is, I've also come from Bolivia, which is in South America, and you know, it's an underdeveloped country by comparison in terms of this paradigm. And what I personally experienced was the inability to actually do many of the things I had learned to do, you know, thanks to this augmented reality experience I had, you know, in my education and college. So, you know, it took me a while to figure how things worked in terms of finding things without the internet, how to build a social network without the internet, and things of the like that are extremely important in social contexts.
So, I mean, I'd like to relate that a little bit to, you know, the experience we have when we first learned to use a calculator, and then, you know, we just completely forget about how to do a division, I mean, let alone a square root, right? So I just want to understand if you have thought a bit about that, you know, and how that can increase a gap between abilities that could be natural to human beings and others that could certainly advance science.
Well, I like the question very much, and what it gets me to thinking about is the whole issue of why we build a virtual environment, why we use an immersive interface. And from an education perspective, it's always to empower people in the real world. From an entertainment perspective, it's typically to draw people deeper and deeper into the virtual world. So, for example, I had a master's student a couple years ago who came to us from a game company. And we involved him in the River City Project, and one of the first things he said to us was, how much time do you spend thinking about the next 10-minute problem? And we all looked blank, and he said, in game companies, we spend most of our time talking about, no matter where you are in the game, how do we keep you playing for 10 more minutes? And actually, that's a great way to think about learning. You know, no matter where you are in the learning experience, how do we keep you learning for 10 more minutes? I found that very evocative in terms of thinking about River City. But it is also, in a sense, the wrong metaphor for immersive interfaces, because you want to fade the immersive interface. You want to draw people back into the real world. Now, let me center on your question. If the virtual world achieves its power by your learning skills and capabilities you don't have in the real world, then it's not buying you very much. That's why all the claims about gaming teaching all these real world skills are very hollow to me. You don't learn economics by learning how to gather gold in the elf fields. You don't learn leadership by learning how to get your team together and kill an ogre. I'm sorry, it is tempting to make the metaphor to faculty meetings, but in fact, the transfer breaks down pretty quickly. So the challenge in virtual worlds is you're building a model. And like all models, whether they're immersive or not, there's a tension between simplicity and validity. And somehow we need to find models that are valid to the core, the power of what you're learning. But they're simple enough, and especially they're simple enough to be learnable, and they're non-magical enough that you're not coming back out into the real world, and none of your incantations work, and so you don't have the power after all. Charlie.
Maybe, yeah, we'll wrap up maybe with this question.
I've been very interested to know whether it's possible to establish correlations between skills in games, strategic games and social games, with employable skills. And am I hearing you say that, no, you can't really establish a transfer of the skills of World of Warcraft to any workable skills of organization and perseverance and qualities that would lead an employer to say, this is actually a credential for you that you're a 72 druid or whatever?
I'm saying that I'm very skeptical about claims of far transfer, and that when I look at the research evidence that is in back of those claims, it's very, very weak. I am not skeptical about claims of near transfer. In fact, a lot of my work deals with trying to create near transfer and understand near transfer. So let me give you an example. If I came to you and I said, I'm incredibly good in World of Warcraft, and therefore I will be good in courtroom situations because I can think fast on my feet, and I'm ready to deal with surprises, and I have an aggressive stance towards the world. I mean, you know better than I do what would make do in a courtroom. I'm just making this up based on my naive knowledge about courtroom tactics. My guess is that you would give different credence to different parts of that statement. So you might say, this probably is somebody that can think on their feet. This probably is somebody that, faced with a courtroom situation that goes south somehow, could make a pretty fast decision about how to handle it. But I'm much more skeptical about whether aggression in the courtroom correlates with the ability to be aggressive in World of Warcraft. One of them is kind of a far transfer, the other one is more of a near transfer. That would be my response.
Has there actually been a body of research that's taken, say, the classic test, psychological tests that employers would use to identify skills and somehow applied them to a body of gamers and see whether there are correlations between game skills and readily used employment metrics?
Not that I have found. I think the closest thing that you get to that is the military, where the military does have evidence that shows that people that are skilled in the military bring a whole skill set into civilian life. And those skills in the military have been honed a lot through military simulation, unless you've been in combat situations, which wasn't true for a bunch of people before the current administration. You were gaining those skills largely through simulation. So that's the best body of evidence in terms of what you're talking about. I know we're out of time. I want to thank you all again for coming. I hope this was fun and interesting for you.
Thank you very much.